Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. From time to time, we've devoted these lectures to the role of the media, and of course, every free country needs a vigorous media. There's the respectable media, and then there's what might be called the disrespectful media. We've not got sound. Sound? Have we sound? Yes, right. As I was saying, every free country needs a respectable media and then a not-so-respectful media. And the not-so-respectful media has at its disposal these days modern technology. You only have to remember Jack Wilkes. You remember Jack Wilkes, who was one of the scurrilous journalists of the 18th century, who's now regarded as a great champion of liberty. We now have Jack Wilkes with the internet, and today we have her with us, I think I could say, Australia's answer to Jack Wilkes, armed with the internet, and he's going to tell us all about the significance of that. Please welcome Stephen Mayne.
Well, thanks for that, Harry. I must say it's nice to actually be able to get in the building. It was quite ironic that in the early days of Crikey we were basically in political terms a vehicle for the Costello forces, and we were basically running their line very aggressively and getting stuck into the PM at every opportunity and pushing the Costello faction. And then I guess things turned around and we started calling the Treasurer sort of nicknames like Dollar Sweetie and talking about his glass jaw, and next thing you know we've been banned by the Treasurer from the budget lockup. So I always find it ironic that the great rationale for allowing concentration of media ownership in Australia is that the internet opens up the field to everyone, so you can access the BBC and Fox News and any blog you like. Therefore we can allow all our major media companies to merge. Yet when it comes to the major set piece of the year in political terms in Australia, the budget, the number one independent internet business is not allowed to attend. So I think that the government's hypocrisy on that is quite stunning. And as Australia's most unsuccessful candidate, who's I think lost 33 times now in total, including 26 corporate elections and Melbourne City Council, Jeff Kennett's old seat, Melbourne Press Club, the RACV, you name it, I've run for it and I've lost. But I've never actually run in a federal election, so I'm tempted to run in Higgins on a Let Us Into the Budget Lockup platform. So I thought I'd better give a bit of personal background before talking more broadly about the internet. I was just a regular mainstream journalist, focusing mainly on business. I've worked for the Herald Sun, The Age, the Fin Review, the Daily Telegraph as a gossip columnist, chief of staff, business editor, business reporter. Also, 18 months as a spin doctor for Jeff Kennett, right at the beginning of the Kennett revolution, when for mine it still was the most dramatic period we've seen from any government in Australia in terms of reforms that a government tried to push through. I've done the whistleblower thing, leaking stories to Today Tonight anonymously about Jeff Kennett's dodgy share dealings, and then I guess my experience from that, when that didn't quite have the effect that I hoped, which was to knock Jeff off, I then tried the full-blown whistleblower thing on Four Corners. So I went out there and appeared on Four Corners and made all these allegations about Jeff Kennett, and that didn't work, so I left Victoria and said, too good, punters don't care, and went up to Sydney. And then I tried the candidate thing when I figured that because the media had been, in my view, so soft on Jeff, that the only way to get the issues out there was to actually run as a candidate in Jeff Kennett's seat. And unfortunately I was ruled ineligible, and then decided that I couldn't get a job back with the mainstream media because I'd bagged them all for being too soft on Jeff. So I had no alternative at that point but to turn to the internet. And I published a website called Jeft.com during the 1999 state election, which I think to this day is still quite unique in the world, in that it did have an impact on the election result. If you look at what happened, Kennett was the hot favourite. He launched his own website, jeff.com.au, which was designed by Sausage Software, one of the tech boom companies, and he was the cool, hip guy embracing a medium that he couldn't control. And so I came out and launched jeff.com as the shadow site to that. Now, anyone could have done that, and it might not have had any effect, but the difference that I had was that I was a former insider, and I had a whole pile of information that was unique and quite sensitive. So I'd found the restrictions of the mainstream is that when I did a tell-all interview on Four Corners, their lawyers took out about 70% of what I was hoping to put into the public arena. So I found other media outlets were a bit nervous about running some of the more aggressive things that I was saying about Jeff Kennett. And I think it's just worth briefly mentioning a couple of them. Hounding out the DPP from public office, $400,000 defamation settlement with Kerry Packer at a time when Kerry Packer had made $100 million out of the casino. First government since William of Orange to sack judges. World's biggest casino, world's biggest toll road. Got rid of 100,000 workers. Reduced the public sector workforce from 260,000 to 160,000. Closed 10% of schools. I mean, it was a dramatic revolution. Sold $40 billion worth of assets. It was a dramatic revolution. But for mine, there was also some ethical issues. And the big thing that I had up my sleeve was that I'd basically been Jeff's de facto stockbroker in the office, and I'd been a party to him doing some utterly inappropriate share trading, which was ringing up stockbrokers and securing large allocations of shares in hot floats and then placing them in his wife's name and not disclosing it to Parliament. And it was pretty amazing stuff that he was doing. So I had the material. And the key thing about this that I want to stress today is you've got to have the content. It doesn't matter if you're on the web, if you've got nothing meaningful to say, that they won't read it, it won't have an impact. It's the old build it and they will come. Reveal it and they will come. It does not matter what the medium is, whether it's the internet, whether it's a great biography on John Howard, whether it's exclusive on a TV show. It all comes down to the content. And in the case of Kennett, I had the content. So what happened was I needed to get a platform to get some attention. So I announced I was running against Jeff, and this got some publicity. And because I knew I was going to start ripping into the media, and as soon as I started doing that, I would get banned by some sections of the media, and there's no point having a blog or a website if no one knows about it. So the key person in Victoria who made Jeff an item, made it a big thing, was John Fain on the ABC. So what happened was I put 20,000 words up on the web detailing every possible last grievance that I had about Jeff, and on the first day it had 800 page views. On the second day, it had 1,500 page views. And then John Fain rang me at 7:30 one morning and said, "I've just read it. That is amazing. I'm going to plug it when I've got 250,000 listeners tomorrow." So the next morning, 7:30, he said, "You must read Jeff.com. It has some amazing revelations about Jeff Kennett." We had 8,000 page views that day, and basically we did 115,000 page views over the two-week period. So this was literally launched 2 weeks out, and had 110,000 page views. At the end of the campaign, we were getting more traffic than the ALP site and the Republic site, given the referendum was coming up. So that was a lot of traffic in a short time, and it did, I think, change the outcome of the election. And the reason for that was not, voters going to the website, reading the material and changing their vote. The key thing was that it influenced the media. And for mine, the old media is still all-powerful in Australian politics, but what happened was a media insider was out there saying, "Jeff's doing all these things, the media's soft, these are the stories they've missed," and I basically put them under great pressure to give Jeff a tougher time. And Jeff had a really bad last week of the election, and he lost in the greatest shock that we've seen in 50 years in Australian elections. And I basically at that point was shocked myself, because I was consigned to moving back to Sydney and leaving Victoria. So I had to decide what on earth I would do next. And I couldn't get a job back with the mainstream, so I said, all right, we better launch something else. So I can't have a website called Jeff when there's no Jeff. So we decided to launch Crikey in February of 2000. And once again, in the case of Crikey, it is the content that absolutely matters. And I had the marketing thing of the guy who helped bring down Jeff. And our slogan for the first few years of Crikey was bringing down governments since September 1999, which was a bit full of itself, of course. But, you know, people had written that we had had an impact, and so we traded on that. But then if Crikey had rubbish content, it would have sunk like a stone. And what happened was a guy, Christian Kerr, who was a former staffer to Senator Hill and the South Australian Premier John Olson, started writing an anonymous column for Crikey under the Hillary Bray name. And in political terms, once again, it was the content. We had great, unique content because Christian had insights that the rest of the media didn't have. He effectively was a whistleblower writing anonymously under a fake name on a website that I was prepared to run and take the risks on defamation and the opprobrium of the media and all this sort of stuff. So over the years, I had it for 5 years, and even to this day, I've accumulated an amazing enemy list. I've upset a lot of people. I'm a bit worried that Glenn Muir might be in the audience today and would push me off the stage if he was here. But, it was not that it was the distribution mechanism of the internet. It was the content. And we basically had very, very good content. And again, everyone says it's the internet which is the key, but it wasn't actually that with Crikey. It was the distribution model. It was the email. For mine, email is absolutely the key. And what Crikey now has today is, I think, Australia's biggest and most powerful email list. We've got 46,000 people who are on that email list who receive an email from Crikey each day. And for instance, we've got 375 of them who have Parliament House email addresses. So the aph.gov.au. Now, Harry was telling me earlier there's about 4,000 people who work in Parliament. But for our little independent e-zine to be hitting 375 of them every day is, you know, incredible. And if you want to hit the house on the hill, you've got to get something into Crikey. So Crikey has become the place to go if you want to reach Australia's most powerful email audience. And a couple of other stats. We've got, for instance, 460 people from with abc.net.au. So the journalists, the people who make the news, also receive the Daily Crikey, and that's also very important. It goes into business, goes into the law. 87 people from Freehills, 158 people from Macquarie Bank. So it's a very well-connected and powerful audience. And Crikey's basically become, if you like, an aggregator. That the demand-supply equation has changed with the internet. There is now far more information than people actually need or know what to look for. And Crikey basically, you know, we receive hundreds of emails a day and we filter what's coming in. So we decide this is a value or this is not a value. We put the links in there and we point people to things out there that are going to be of interest. Now, so how did Crikey get to this point? Well, you know, we had to break some big stories. And the biggest was the downfall of Natasha Sotospoja. And basically, that was a case of we had received a lot of material from Democrat staffers, particularly Meg Lee's supporters. They were airing their grievances about Natasha through us. We were the only media outlet that took any interest in it, so we were like publishing, you know, a lot of trivial stuff. We probably published far too much stuff about the Democrats and Natasha. But when the big one came, which was all that correspondence between Natasha and the head office and the national committees and these sort of things, and when the real fight exploded between Meg and Natasha, the material came to us and we were able to publish it in full. And that's one of the most important things about the internet, is it allows you to publish vast amounts of material. And we've seen it as a classic example with Dr. Hanif this week. It wasn't the act of giving the transcript of interview to The Australian, which was the key thing, with Australian then summarised it in a story that, you know, was, what, 1,000 words. It was the publication of the full 142 words. And that, in my mind, is a key way as to how the internet has transformed politics in a major way. The accountability that comes from every Hansard being available, from every committee, from every doorstop that politicians do, it holds them to account far more on what they said and when. I can remember when I left Jeff Kennett's office. I spent 2 days in there printing out every press release that he'd ever put out, because when I was going back to the Herald Sun, I would need to know what he had said when to hold him to account. Now, you don't need that, because there's all back copies of press releases and speeches and doorstops and everything you could possibly want out there on the web. Political donations figures. I mean, in the old days, it was very difficult to get your mind around what was happening. You had to go to a particular office to see, to search the figures. Now, it's all up on the web. February the 1st each year, there's an absolute deluge of material, and you can search it and you can compile it and you can hold politicians to account. You can ask the ask the companies who's donating. Well, I went to the Macquarie Bank annual meeting yesterday and, you know, read out a list of the donations they've given that have been disclosed on the internet. And 10 years ago when I was going to the Macquarie Bank AGMs, you couldn't have done that because you just wouldn't have had the material. So, and I have to say, the other stories that were important for Crikey in terms of building a brand were, and you know, I'm a bit reluctant to say this, but the Cheryl and Gareth affair thing was probably, you know, our most notorious moment, where Laurie Oakes came out and said, "Cheryl's got a big secret," and we came out and said, "And this is what it is." And it was pretty controversial at the time, but Laurie then came out that night on the news and said, "And here's the email evidence," and so he got us out of jail, so to speak. But that was big. And the other one, which was, it's not really remarked upon much, but in 2002 there was a major factional fight in the ALP, which, when Crean tried to change the voting powers with the unions from 60-40 to 50-50, and there was a major power struggle in Victoria. And what happened was a whole bunch of the players, like the actual senior political players, wrote about this on Crikey. And we published 35,000 words in a matter of about 8 weeks under bylines like Delia Delegate, Betty Branch Member, Reg the Representative. It was all the factional heavies, the politicians themselves and their string pullers writing under fake names, basically pitching an argument to try and affect the vote at a forthcoming state conference. And one of Steve Baxter's advisors said to me later, "That's got to be the first time in the world that a major political power struggle has taken place on a third-party website." And I think that's what actually happened. They were pitching to the 500 delegates who were voting. 35,000 words poured out. The public's knowledge of the factional manoeuvrings of the ALP in Victoria tripled as a result of that process. Never mentioned in the mainstream press. And an amazing amount of information placed out there. And at that point we said, you know, we sort of set up this division in Crikey called the Las Vegas division, which was, "We'll host your fight, you know, so come along." "Come along and, you know, we'll give you the protection of no byline." And that was a key point about Crikey, was that we took risks, we published material that others wouldn't publish, and we allowed powerful people to write under nom de plumes and to put information out there which was different from what the mainstream media did. And I should say that, speaking for the Department of the Senate, that one of my favourite old senators is, of course, well, one of my least favourite is Senator Nick Baulkes, who I gave $25,000 in settling a defamation action. And one of my favourites is Noel Crichton Brown, notorious senator. And I don't think I'm telling too many secrets to say that people have worked this out, and I've mentioned it obliquely in the past. But NCB basically was sitting over there in WA. He'd been thrown out of the Liberal Party. He was still a factional power broker. And he rings me up one day in 2000 or 2001 and says, "You know, can I start writing for you?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's a bit scary with all you've heard about Noel, but all right, you know, send a piece through and I'll have a look at it." So this absolute deluge came down over the next 3 years, and NCB basically lined up every one of his enemies he ever had and one by one executed them on Crikey. And it was forensic. It was amazingly detailed. It was amazingly vitriolic. I'd have to take out about 20 adjectives from each piece, because he'd, you know, someone would be an absolutely disgraceful and horrific, and you just have to sort of tone it down to, you know, "I don't like this person," sort of thing. So, this was an example of a political power player who'd lost his power, and which he'd exercised ruthlessly through the formal channels, and then basically embraced the internet, because he knew I had the audience. He knew that Crikey had the politicians who were reading, all the people he wanted to hurt were on it, were reading it, and he was affecting votes over in WA. He was, you know, demolishing people, and I had a lot of people saying, you've been captured by NCB. And so what I used to do is I used to ring up Christian, our political guru, and I'd say, oh, I'm feeling a bit bad, I'm captured by NCB. And so Christian would launch another attack on NCB, and then Noel would ring me up and go, what the hell is your bloke doing ripping into me? I've given you all these grace stories. Oh, no, I can't control him. He doesn't know what to do. Because I was just feeling really sort of bad at being captured, and journos were saying, you're just captured by NCB. And I sort of, the whole approach of Crikey was let everyone have a spray, let everyone have a say, and people are the wiser for seeing the debate. So if an NCB wants to put a piece up, that's fine, as long as it's not outrageously defamatory. And with NCB, you knew it was forensically researched in terms of the facts. And then if someone wanted to come back and have a flail back at NCB, that's fine. All comers are welcome at Crikey. And we had a lot of that. And we hosted a number of powerful, influential political people writing under fake names to get material out there. And it sort of highlighted in a way one of the downsides of the internet is it really does make the whole dirt sheet thing a lot easier. And it's just such a mechanism that you can't control that, traditionally they all sort of distribute the dirt sheet into letterboxes or by the mail. It happened a bit, but now it's so much easier just to go onto a blog and put an anonymous posting up there ripping into someone. And it's very difficult to control, as John Howe discovered this week with YouTube, where he puts his message up there and then he's deluged with, 50 to 100 negative comments and negative postings from people. And I think it was a salutary lesson to him that someone whose government is the most available to the media in the world, there is no other government anywhere which spends so much of its time talking on the radio, talking on the television, engaging with the media, that I think John Howard's embrace of YouTube this week was an absolute disaster, because Labor came up with such a brilliant response and he just looked so stilted, and then he got very little traffic and it was hard to find his thing on YouTube, so he couldn't command a prominent position on YouTube, and then he got absolutely bollocked by all the people who posted on it. And I think the lesson for John Howard is just don't bother with YouTube. It's not your audience. They're not going to vote for you, and you just look silly on there. And try something different. Now I'm going to give a few other points just about the internet. There's Internet 1.0 and there's Internet 2.0. Now Internet 1.0 was basically putting stuff out there that previously wasn't online, and that's where sort of the Hansards and the political donations and all those things going online, every politician having a website, came into play. But it wasn't very interactive. Now the whole Web 2.0 phenomenon now is all about the interaction. It's all about allowing the community to have a say. It's all about allowing posts up there, and it's about meeting and associating with people, forming friendship groups through which you can swap information and exchange ideas with. Now what it's led to in a way is that it's a bit like the music industry, how it's become so fragmented that the idea of mainstream music isn't really around anymore now. Everyone's got all their sort of niches and they like their particular music. And it's the same with the web and all these social groups that create. People go and find other people who have similar views to theirs. So the internet now allows people to reaffirm their own preconceptions about politics, their own prejudices, their own views, by finding other like-minded people on particular blogs or particular papers around the world or whatever. And it does disempower the mainstream media to a degree, but there's a fundamental difference in the Australian and the US political systems, which makes the internet far less important in Australia than it is in the US. And that is the whole thing about compulsory voting, is that in the US, particularly with the primaries, you actually don't have very many people who are making the votes and participating in it. So people who set up blogs that are designed to influence primaries in the US are attracting people who will be voting on the primaries. They're attracting partisans, they're attracting political junkies, and they all exchange information and they can generate genuine material that will change votes, enough votes that will affect an outcome. The same thing doesn't happen in Australia because the vast majority of people aren't interested in the internet, and the vast majority of people are voting in Australia. The average turnout is still 93%. So if you want to reach enough people via the internet to change votes, it's very, very difficult. And I discovered this personally last year, and I said, oh, well, I did Jeff.com. We can do that again. So I ran in the Victorian election last year. I spent $35,000. I set up a website called Braxt.com, trying to trade off the back of Jeff.com. I didn't particularly have the original content that I had with Jeff because I hadn't been an insider who could blurt all this stuff out like I had with Jeff Kennett. And I built up an email list of about 3,000 people and I was pumping out stuff every day. But I barely got any mentions in the mainstream media. The mainstream media pretty much ignored me and our little party called People Power. And I got a miserable 1.3% and it had absolutely no effect whatsoever. And it just got me thinking about, at the end of the day, from that experience of trying to get up an alternative political candidacy and party, it was incredibly difficult, I found. And the bottom line was that Australian politics is still dominated by the old media, and that they still command millions of eyeballs, and the circulations of the News Limited papers and the viewerships of the free-to-air stations is still, still vast. It still runs into the millions, compared to even crikey's 46,000 email lists and even the traffic that goes to the Mumble blogs and online opinion and all these sort of places. The online space in Australia really is for the junkies and for the specialists. And I don't think there have been too many examples where the internet has fundamentally changed election outcomes in Australia. Sure, you've got to have your own site and it's cool to be on MySpace and have your own page, and politicians are embracing that. And Labor's use of YouTube this week was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I think it was actually a key moment in the use of the internet in Australia. But it actually didn't necessarily need to be YouTube. It was just the old traditional Labor Today released a TV ad, which is what it was. And even if they hadn't posted on YouTube, it still would have had a big run in the mainstream media because they would have done the old Labor releases TV ad. Here's John Howard with his eyebrows and that amazing shot of the old, the pictures of Bush and Howard and in the bed. Very powerful images about being asleep with climate change and had a far bigger impact because it followed Howard trying to embrace YouTube. But it wasn't the people visiting YouTube that affected it. It was the fact that it ran on all the TV bulletins and it made the front page of the papers. So it was the old media's mentioning of the YouTube that made it. And that was my experience with Jeff. It wasn't people coming to Jeff that changed things. It was the mainstream media mentioning it. So if you're going to be successful in changing politics in Australia from the internet's perspective, you have to have a partnership effectively with the mainstream media, which still dominates the traffic figures. Even if you look at who are the top websites in Australia, it's all the same old media. It's still 9MSN, Fairfax, News Limited and the ABC. So the old media, which is supposedly going to be broken down by the internet and a thousand flowers blooming, taking it on, is actually dominating about 90% of the relevant traffic in terms of political coverage and people getting political information. So I don't think it's changed as much as a lot of other people say. You might say it's surprising to hear that, but I think it's actually overstated in terms of the impact. There are a couple of other interesting phenomena I just want to mention about the technologies and how they've changed things. There's a website in the States called Digit, which you might have heard of, which is democratising what is good in the media. So what happens is if you like a story, you will say, click, I dig this. And then it goes to the website in the States, and stories get ranked based on the number of clicks they've had. And this website now has 1.5 million members. It gets 140 million page views a month. And at the bottom of every News Limited story on their website and on some of the Fairfax sites, they say, do you dig this? So you've got this website in America getting plugged by Australian newspaper sites saying, please say you dig this. And then you go to the dig site and the stories that have been most popular, i.e. voted by the punters, not chosen by the journalists or the editors, but voted by the punters, they rise to the top. And that is where obscure blog postings and things that wouldn't normally be discovered are actually getting introduced to a wider audience. And that actually is a very good example of democracy coming to what is important news, what is worthwhile reading news. And that's an example, I think, of how the internet has changed things in terms of the way people are consuming their media. In terms of what's going to happen with the 2007 election, I mentioned GetUp, which people are talking about GetUp as being a powerful political tool in Australia, and based on a US model which has been successful over there. Now, GetUp does have a large email list. I get their missives every day. But I think that the problem with GetUp is that people are too associated with the left and with the Labor Party, with some of their founders now being endorsed Labor politicians. And yes, they did manage to galvanise people, and probably the best example was the protest they ran outside Parliament House here on David Hicks with a GetUp campaign. They are an emerging force, and they should be watched. But at the end of the day, I think it is, even with GetUp, a little bit overstated, is that it is effectively just part of what was already a very active community amongst the green groups and the unions and the left, who've just picked a slightly different tool and tried to dress it up as a new and innovative thing. I think a couple other points I want to make in terms of how the internet is changing politics. One of the most important is fundraising, particularly in the States, is the mechanism by which you can raise money is absolutely important. And certainly my discovery last year with trying to do People Power is that mainstream media and money are still the two biggest things to open up, to crack it in politics. The US election next year will be the world's first $1 billion election, and that is massively expensive. And while the internet does break down some costs, it doesn't break down enough. And in the Australian context, you try and get up a political party and man every booth and print out millions of how to vote cards, it literally costs you a fortune. So until in Australia we get things like direct voting, like internet voting, which takes away the barrier, the people barrier of manning all those booths and the actual costs of printing all those how to vote cards and putting all the bunting up and the signs up at polling booths, until you get something like that, the barriers to entry that we need to see from the internet to open it up to other parties aren't going to be there. And I think the barriers are as strong as they've ever been. I mean, can anyone see anyone getting up and challenging the Australian political duopoly? I mean, is the internet throwing up new and fresh candidates? I mean, where independent players are doing best is where the internet is least placed, like in regional seats and Pauline Hanson. I mean, Pauline Hanson was certainly not an internet generation embracing her. She was very much a non-internet generation embracing her as told by the mainstream media. It was a classic example of mainstream media creation. MySpace, if you're a politician, it's cool. You've got to be on MySpace. It's worth having your page. Obama's got his hundreds of thousands of friends on MySpace. But again, I think it's just in the Australian context, the vast majority of the population aren't interested in politics. So the politicians have got to project themselves into what they are interested in. So they've got to present themselves into the YouTubes and the MySpaces, which are basically about entertainment and networking amongst friends. So, for a political class which is largely ignored by a majority of the voters, particularly the young voters, it makes sense to present into their space where they are interacting and talking. But I think you've got to do it, coolly and properly. And certainly the way John Howard did it this week wasn't an example of that. I guess finally, I'd just like to talk about make a few more comments about the media and what it means. I think actually the internet's influence is far more profound on the media than it is on politics. And one of the very important things is the way it is fundamentally undermining independent quality journalism, because the revenues that support independent journalism are being seriously attacked. Seek.com doesn't pay for any journalism, yet it is massively eating the lunch of Fairfax and News Limited by taking away direct classified advertising revenue. So literally you are going to see things like The Age and The Sydney Morning Herald merging their bureaus. You are going to see less investigation into journalism, because the internet is full of commentary and opinion. And commentary and opinion is cheap. It is easy. It's full of self-opinionated people banging on, often saying things which are unparticularly of value to anyone. Really useful, unique information that changes the public debate, making uncomfortable disclosures about politicians that are in the public interest, that doesn't come cheap. You need serious journalists doing serious research to do that. Now, there are some aspects of the internet which augment investigative journalism in a very positive way, and I'd give you the typical Four Corners story. 10 years ago, Four Corners was a three-month investigation and then just 45 minutes of television, that was it. Now it is a collaboration between the final product that goes to air and the full transcripts and the full interviews with all the talent, and you actually get far more accountability and far more information from a typical Four Corners program because they give you all the research documents. They make it a far more fulfilling and deep research project, and that does add a lot of value, add a lot of value to it. So I think that it is a real worry that quality journalism is not going to be as well funded in Australia, that there is too much easy opinion and cheap opinion on the internet. The other thing that people talk about the internet is this whole notion of citizen journalism and how citizen journalism will change the way that politics happens and that media happens. And in some senses, that's right. So, Hurricane Katrina was a classic example where because of people with their phones taking photos, you actually had a situation where the media knew more about what was happening after Cyclone Katrina than George Bush knew. And the lesson for George Bush was that I don't think he ever really recovered from sitting up there in Washington saying, we just didn't have the information. We just didn't know what was going on. And yet, meanwhile, on websites and all over the place, there was pictures, there was imagery, there was live reports. And the reality for George Bush was he looked like a guy who was too slow and out of touch. And in this 24-hour news cycle that we now have, the key thing for politicians, and I think in terms of the 24-hour news cycle, it is round-the-clock cable TV, things like that, which are actually almost more important than the internet, that the initial response from a politician is now far more important, and it becomes more indelibly implanted into the public opinion. In the old days, something happened, you'd have 4 or 5 hours to consider your response, and you could come out and, draft a statement, talk to the lawyers, consult a few people, and put it out there. Now, for the politicians, it's all about getting out there quickly. And if you don't get out there quickly and decisively, it can do you some serious damage. And I think the whole Katrina reaction from Bush was a great example of that. Now, there's also some dangers in this. Do you remember the story of, in terms of the media being responsible for putting information out there? Remember the story of the Brazilian electrician who got shot by the British cops? Now, the citizen journalists who reported that said that this guy sprinted into the station, leapt over the barrier, was running away from the cops and got shot. And everyone thought, bomber about to explode something, and he got shot. And that went round the world. The BBC, live witnesses, reported this. What actually happened was he strolled in, he put his ticket in, he went through the bar, he bought a newspaper, and he's walking down the train station, and he got shot. So the initial response put out there by the citizen journalists, eyewitnesses, was actually inaccurate. But a lot of people still had that in their mind, that that's what happened. It's a really good example of how quick responses are absolutely vital, and it's a big challenge for politicians to actually get out there, be fleet-footed, and get out there with an instant response. Because if you don't, the public's opinion, the media cycle will have moved on and the public's opinion will have been set in train against you. And as I said, I don't think Bush ever really recovered from that perception about how slow he was. I guess the final comment I'd make is that the internet does, to some degree, take the journalists out of the equation. Is that you are seeing a more direct conversation between the politicians and the public, and that's our crikey model. We actually like to keep the journalists out of it and go to the direct players and ask them to write about what's happened to them. And the same with blogging, is politicians are actually, like Andrew Bartlett is actually directly communicating with his audience and his followers, rather than relying on the mainstream media, the gatekeeper, if you like, the journalists, from deciding whether that's interesting or not, and then distilling the information, maybe getting some quotes wrong and putting it out there. So there is this process called disintermediation where the journalists as gatekeepers are actually being largely bypassed now, and the internet has been an important factor in that. So look, I've probably banged on for far too long, and I always say to people that there's not a lot of accountability on the internet, that there's no press council like the newspapers have, and there's no television, there's no ACMA like TV and radio have. And I lost my house, we got sued for defamation, and I had to move house 5 times in 30 months, and that is a level of accountability. But actually these forums a much better level of accountability. So I always encourage people to get up and ask very hard-hitting questions and really rip into me and give me a left jab, because I find it's a good way to be held accountable, because it is a bit of a law of the jungle on the internet. You can say what you like, and you know, there's a bit of a perception that people aren't held to account. So feel free to be as aggressive as you like, with the exception of a Glenn Milnes stage storming performance. And so thanks very much for your time today.
Could I ask any questioners to use the microphone? Yes, we have a gentleman in the back row. If you come to the microphone, that would be good.
G'day, Stephen. Richard Dennis. I promised myself I wasn't going to ask you a question today, but then you used Natasha as your big highlight of Crikey. So, in the interest of full disclosure, I was Natasha Stottesboy's chief of staff. I now work for the Greens. You raised some really important points, and congratulations on Crikey, by the way. I'm not going to be as aggressive as people might think. But on the one hand, you say it's so important to reveal to voters, you know, here's what Jeff Kennett's doing behind the scenes, here's this stuff, because presumably you think people need context. It's not just the decisions that politicians make, but, you know, the reasons that they might do that or the things that they might benefit from. So, and I agree, I think that's very important. But then on the other hand, you say, isn't it great how we allow anonymous vitriol to be posted on a website? So, and you say, but that's all right, because we invite everyone to leak, to conceal their identity, you know, to lie to their colleagues. We think, you know, we're open, we're democratic, we invite everyone to lower their personal standards. So, you know, as Natasha's chief of staff, I'm sure you can comb your files and not find one email from myself defending Natasha. Certainly you won't find one attacking the people who were attacking her. Yet your readers are reading stuff saying, oh, did you know Natasha did this, not disgruntled ex-chief of staff who lost job and got big pay cut has something nasty to say about Natasha. You've just got an assertion and an allegation. So if context is so important that we have the full picture and that Crikey can be the bringer of truth to this, how can we achieve that if we're actually just putting, I'd say, cowardice on a pedestal and inviting other people to play just as grubby a version of gossip?
Well, look, it's a good point, and it's the big challenge for any blogger or any mainstream media site that is running an unmoderated forum. And this is the big issue that they're grappling with now, is if you allow anyone to come in and make a posting, you are effectively giving them a vehicle, a platform to say whatever they like, and you're exposing yourself to defamation. And the important point to note about Crikey is that we've never actually done that. And I used to get 200 to 300 emails a day, only 10% of which would ever have seen the light of day. So the key role that I had as the gatekeeper then, well, I effectively was the moderator, was in sifting wheat from chaff. So I don't know how many times I didn't run John Howard's having an affair with Prue Goward. I mean, it was bollocks. It wasn't right. And I didn't put it up there. And, you know, there's any number of other examples that, like that. In the case of Natasha, I do quite openly say that we ran too much trivial, petty stuff from disaffected Democrats. I think that we probably were overall unfair on Natasha. But what happened in the end was that when the big story came, it actually came to us because we were the only outlet that had really taken an interest in the minutiae. And after that, you know, I've actually basically not criticised Natasha ever since she left the leadership. Pretty much just, you know, I actually felt a bit comfortable. I mean, she ended up marrying an old flatmate of mine, and we had a lot of tension. But I do agree with you that I was running what you would call a receiver model, which was, I didn't wake up in the morning and say, right, this is a good story. Journalists 1, 2, and 3 go and do 3 FOIs. You ring 10 people on the street, ask them this, and this is our idea for the day. I had no resources for that. I was sitting in the spare room at home. I had defamation cases coming at me and big debts, and I basically was sitting on the end of the email pipe, and if it came in, I would say yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, whatever, and out it went. And in those early days, I do think a little bit too much got through on Natasha, and I'm quite open to say that. But at another level, if Natasha or anyone else supporting her had wanted to put a piece in, we would happily have run it. And if we got something wrong, we would happily correct it. And I think that Crikey did have the most transparent and open corrections policy and right of reply policy. And the best example I'll give you is Terry McCran sent me through a 6,000-word piece attacking me, which started off, "Stephen, you are in what polite circles is known as a complete fuck." And then it went on, the 6,000 words just absolutely sprang me, and I happily published it because I'd criticised him and he gets a go. In the mainstream media, you'd never get that. You never get, you know, people getting a prominent correction on A Current Affair or the front page of The Age. So I did let more stuff through than I should have, but the policy was to never ban someone from having a right of reply and allowing that. And Natasha and her supporters simply didn't choose to take that up. And that was, I guess, how it panned out. But I do, you know, you've got some fair points, and it's something I do think about quite a bit.
Thank you for a very entertaining presentation. Crikey costs $115 a year subscription, and worth every penny it is too. Presumably that makes it, it's copyright material anyway. What is your policy on subscribers forwarding copies of crikey.com emails to non-subscribers? And if you think it's a perfectly fair thing to do, do I run the risk of defamation the same as you do if I do so?
Look, we say that you can't. There are ways and means of actually seeing people who do, but it's illegal to then pursue them. So it's a tricky situation where there is software and ability to actually find out who's doing it, but you can't actually do that. So the only thing you can do is say, please don't do it, and rely on people's honesty. But it's the biggest problem for internet business models is multiple uses of password and massive on passing, and that's why Crikey, for all its size, great email list and whatever, it's actually a pretty small business in terms of revenue. I mean, when I had it, we did $440,000 in the last 12 months that I had it for, and I think they've probably tripled it now. So they've gone from 5,000 subscribers paying $80 to 13,000 paying 100 or 115. So, and they've, quadrupled, they've tenfold increased the advertising. We were doing 7,000 there. They've got a department of four now selling advertising. So, but it's still somewhere, $1.5 million, $2 million in revenue, which in the context of any other commercial media outlet is just an absolute drop in the bucket. So, it's a very tough thing to build a scalable, sustainable business online. And people on passing your product and swapping their passwords and things like that is one of the big problems. So you can only just look people in the eye and say, please don't do it.
Any other questions? Yeah.
G'day, Stephen. I just want to raise something which you've talked about in the past, and that's the defamation laws in Australia. Would Crikey ever have come to its current state if it weren't for the penurious defamation laws? I mean, you prided yourself on running the sort of stories that the big boys wouldn't. If our defamation laws weren't as severe and strict, do you think that the major players would be freer, would be less reluctant to run the sort of stories which Crikey made its name on?
Look, it's an interesting point. In a weird way, the thing that made us was losing our house. Because when Steve Price, the shock jock, injuncted the sale of our house, we literally ran a massive violin marketing campaign saying, evil millionaire shock jock throws internet publisher, wife and new baby onto street. Please subscribe. and it was ka-ching. I mean, our revenues went from $10,000 a month to $30,000 a month on the back of that, and we appointed him our honorary marketing director. So, in a weird way, defamation battles and David and Goliath sort of marketing helped make us, but it was, moving house five times in 30 months whilst you're having three kids was a hell of a struggle. But I got sued three times, and two of them where I paid out, 50 to Steve Price and 25 to Nick Balkus, were mistakes, like inaccurate material, and then magnified by me with either inflammatory responses, you know, handing out flyers outside 3RW saying Steve Price shouldn't sue, you know, provocative stuff. And I learned a lesson when we lost our house, which was the moment anyone threatens you, collapse, apologise and move on, because it's not worth it. And I literally haven't had a new writ in 6 years. So the open corrections policy, giving everyone a right of reply, saying sorry if you make a mistake, it's transparent and it's fair, and it also stops you getting sued. And I've avoided numerous writs where I knew it was coming, even when I got wind of it. Like, for instance, I mean, I shouldn't say this, Richard, but you know, one of the nicknames we used for Natasha, which was very unfair, was R. Satan, which was Natasha backwards. And she went to see Steve Price's lawyer and was about to issue about that, and I got heard back on the grapevine and announced that we were going to stop doing it before the letter arrived. So it was that type of thing where you pick up stuff where you've gone too far and you need to neutralise, you need to apologise or adopt your policies. And I got sued three times, three different laws, because we had the state-based laws. So I got sued in South Australian law, Victorian law and New South Wales law. Now we've actually had a very good reform driven by Ruddock saying, get a uniform law or I will legislate. And the states have got together, and now uniform laws, which is good. Companies can't sue, which is good, which means there's less writs. And maximum payout of $250,000. Which has actually dramatically reduced the number of defamation writs. So I actually think it's going to be one of the lasting, worthwhile reforms of the Howard government to have facilitated that, albeit the states who agreed on the detail. And given the Howard government's record on free speech and, you know, locking up whistleblowers or, you know, really being aggressive on some of those issues, the defamation changes has actually been very worthwhile. And as I said, the new owners of Crikey haven't had a writ, and I haven't had one in 6 years, so that's good.
Now, there's someone in the upper gallery there.
Like the other speakers, thank you, Stephen, and thanks for adopting an alternative stance. One of the things that runs through a lot of what you're saying is the difference between the argument about hominem and the actual argument. In other words, playing the person or making a personal comment. And sometimes the latter, although less moral, is more strident and takes the argument. Like the drunk trying to get his key into a block of flats door, a woman out the top says, you're trying to get your key into the wrong door, and he says, that's nothing, you got your head out the wrong window. It doesn't actually add to the debate, but it carries a lot of weight. And would you like to say something about how you steer around that?
Look, it's a good point. I've been to a lot of shareholder AGMs. I've filled in on the ABC as a presenter, shock jock, and I've tried to start up a political party, and I've hosted a website. And I can tell you that all of them attract a similar group of people who are often lonely, a little bit eccentric, and they might have a grudge that they want to get out there. And People Power, I used to say, was a grudge factory. We were just people coming in, they were upset, they wanted to sound off. And posting, people who post on bulletin boards on blogs, exactly the same. I mean, blogs and the internet are just all about a massive increase in self-disclosure and expression of opinion. And a lot of it is very, very bad. But similarly, how's it different from talk radio? I mean, a lot of people who ring talk radio, it is, you know, just very ordinary. But that is filtered. The producer, you know, what do you want to talk about and who are you? And it is slightly controlled. And that's where you get a little bit of quality control. But the internet, it's often just anything goes. And so if you think about the issue like political staffers rorting the feedback system, so, you know, the political staffer who sends letters to the newspaper endorsing their candidates, who rings up Talkback and says, isn't it fantastic? Well, it's even easier on the internet just to get out there and start posting, you know, really and totally anonymous and damaging stuff. So I think that, you know, this is user-generated content, but 95% of the content is garbage. It's really very, very ordinary. And okay, it gives people a chance to get something off their chest, gets them a chance to meet other people of like-minded view. But you know, the bloggers on the Australian and News Limited will tell you, you know, it's often the same group of people who are, you know, emailing stuff to Crikey, posting on Matt Price's blog, ringing up Talkback. They're often just looking for, you know, they've got a big grudge and they want to get something off their chest. So, sure, it's great everyone else can have a say, but I agree with you, the quality of it, 95% of the user-generated content is, you know, pretty lamentable and doesn't add much.
Yeah.
Hi, Stephen. I've got a question about fundraising using the internet in the Australian context. In the US in 2003, we saw a marginal Democrat candidate in Howard Dean hit the mainstream by using the internet. This time around, it seems like it's Barack Obama, who was mainstream to start with, making the run over the internet. In the Australian context, we haven't had that happen yet. Do you think here it's going to be an opportunity for the small independent parties or an opportunity for the big players to just keep raking in the dollars?
I think the Australian duopoly is well and truly entrenched. For the things I said earlier about compulsory voting is the key, that it's very difficult for a newcomer, Hanson's the exception, but it's very difficult for a newcomer to explode onto the scene. You've got to have a very charismatic leader with something to go on. And Don Chipp, he was an ex-cabinet, well-known, something to go on. Hanson, endorsed Liberal candidate, controversial comments, and then all commanding big media. So I think that in Australia we've seen very little internet donations. It's just basically the old system of the party heavies go around to the big corporates and the big unions and, you know, give us your big check. You know, Macquarie Bank, $320,000 last year, and nothing to any independent candidate anywhere. So I think that we just have, for various reasons, we have a very entrenched duopoly, and some would say we have the most stable political system in the world. That's the same thing, an entrenched duopoly. And I can't see anything breaking it down too quickly, and I just think the media concentration and the sheer expense of getting up and public funding. Public funding is the other thing that's an absolute killer for a minor party. I spent $35,000, our party spent $200,000, all on the basis that Victoria had introduced public funding and we would get a dollar a vote, or $1.72 a vote for everything over 4%. Not one candidate got over 4%. So public funding delivers tens of millions of dollars to the major parties. It fundamentally bankrolls them, and there's these little barriers to entry where a start-up has got to reach 4% before they get on that trough. And, you know, it's just very, very difficult. So,
Doesn't the internet provide the small players an opportunity to get past those sorts of barriers, though? Like, I'm going back to Howard Dean again. The last US election was the most expensive one they ever had, and he was leading the primaries until he fell apart towards the end, and it was only the internet that got him that far. Are we going to see a similar thing here with the Greens and the Democrats have that same opportunity?
No, because in the primaries it's only a very small number of people, and he was able to galvanise the political junkies who participate and vote in primaries. Here, you have to get millions of people to be Howard Dean. Yeah, and how do you reach them? You can produce fantastic stuff on the internet, but no one will know about it unless you get the John Fain going out and saying, there's this one website which has got great stuff. And that's what I had. So you've got to have something to launch on. You've got to have a platform. And Matt Drudge says, if he was launching the Drudge Report again today, he wouldn't have a clue how to do it, because he had his Monica scoop and that was his thing. So to get off the ground as a new party, you've got to have a major event, and then you've got to be able to keep it together. And, you know, show me a small party standing today that's been able to keep it together. The Greens are still going. They're the only one that haven't, you know, imploded at some level. So I've tried it. You know, I thought I had a bit of profile and platform and whatever, and I can tell you, I won't be doing it again. It's very, very hard. I might run as an independent, you know, but herding cats as a start-up party using the internet, it all sounds good, but dollars, mainstream media, compulsory voting, huge barriers, very entrenched duopoly. We've got Coles and Woolies, we've got Labor and Liberal. You know, that's what it's like.
Any last question? Righty, last question. Could you come to the microphone?
You mentioned Matt Price's blog, which is always very entertaining. What interests me about the blog is it seems to produce political opinions which differ greatly from what the Australian might be saying as a in their opinion pieces. I wonder, do you think that the input of readers of magazines online or newspapers is actually making a difference to how the newspapers are producing their news online? That's one point about the political views. Also, the serious papers like The Age and The Sydney Morning Herald, if you go on and look during the day, they are putting the man bites dog stories up to the top. It's as if they're trying to appeal to a wider audience. Do you think it's a contradiction there, that they're making themselves a kind of popular...
Because they've got that software which ranks the stories most highly, yeah. They've quickly learnt online that, you know, pictures of women and man by dogs type stories are actually often the most popular. It's the dig-it phenomenon. And it's difficult for them to ignore that when the measurement on the internet is just so clear for the world to see. It's like television ratings. You know that a show has flopped because you get an exact figure on the audience for 15-minute breakdowns. With a newspaper, you've got your annual subscriptions, you know you're doing 200,000. Nothing really changes if you put serious politics on the front but the other stuff is buried down the back. So with the internet, you get far more specific information on what's popular, and that tells you the sort of stories that you should do. In terms of newspapers changing their position because of feedback from readers, look, you do get a lot more feedback. In the old days, if you did something controversial, you get a bag full of letters, which no one sees, and you publish two of them, and it's your little secret that you actually had a little revolt there. And circulation might ring up and say, we've dropped 300 subscribers today because of this, and you go, okay, but no one knows it, okay. Whereas when the Daily Telegraph does a splash yesterday, you know, attacking Mike Carlton as a disgrace for his comments about Stan Zamanek, their website was full of comments defending Carlton and saying Zamanek was a lamentable fool who deserved to have that said about him. And that was the readers pushing back in a way that's visible, because they don't censor didn't stop the comments from going up there. So it is more transparent, and the internet is dramatically increasing the number of people who are accessing The Australian. I mean, The Australian, you know, lost money for years. I think it's going to make about $7 million this year. It's doing nicely profitable. And I think actually like $7 million in advertising revenue from the web this year. So they are actually making a good fist of it, and they have a far wider audience. But I don't think it's going to affect what appears in the paper. Now, Chris Mitchell's still got his agenda, and he's going to go on with that, but the whingers can have their say on the blogs, and we'll let debate flourish there. And we'll take note of it a little bit, but I don't think it's really going to fundamentally change a position of a paper like The Australian. Just because, you know, Matt Price's blog gets, you know, different view coming through.
Maybe
from the
Matt Price is the Philip Adams of The Australian.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's certainly not, you know, like the rest of the dancing bears.
Thank you.
Okay, that's all we've got time for. Please join me in thanking our lecturers.